The word of God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and in your notes to the problems with materialism. All right, the Christian way of life is a supernatural lifestyle that is only lived by the believer effectively, who is plus Bible doctrine, who understands the issues related to the Christian way of life, the necessity of being in fellowship, the necessity of walking in the Spirit, and of course the battlefield is the mind, the battlefield is the soul, the real you, that God the Holy Spirit desires to control, and of course that your flesh desires to call the shots as well. So this warfare is internal. It is going to last for the rest of your phase two. You will never ever get away from it. The challenge is to reprogram the brain computer with Bible doctrine to effectively learn how to think in the angelic conflict so that you can effectively assimilate doctrine, effectively apply the doctrine that you know, and glorify God through your life. That is why we are here. We can do nothing to repay God for what he has given us freely in salvation, but we can live our lives in a manner that is commensurate with his word. So to that end, we have assembled together to take in the doctrine, recognizing that this is where it all starts. This is not the end of it, but this is certainly the beginning point, that we are not to be like God's people of the Old Testament who perished for lack of knowledge. So we continue to plow through these things and make the issues plain, hopefully, so that believers can adjust their thinking to the dictates of Scripture and, of course, lay hold of the great rewards which God has for those who diligently seek him. So it's time to make sure you're in fellowship and do whatever else you need to do so that you can profit from the teaching this morning. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the grace that continues to bring us together, recognizing that it is through your plan that we have all been united into one royal family, recognizing that ultimately we are to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace and to serve one another in the local church as is appropriate through the understanding of your word. We pray as we approach Bible doctrine this morning that you will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are dealing here with the issue of materialism. This is a problem with political and economic and prophetic Babylon. We live right in the midst of this culture. In fact, we are immersed in it from the day of our birth. It has not gotten any better. It continues to move along these lines of consumerism, materialism, focused on the physical realities of life to the exclusion sometimes of spiritual priorities. And that really is one of the fundamental problems that we have to deal with, is the values of spiritual priorities as opposed to material priorities. And material priorities are to take a back seat to spiritual priorities. Again, that's the challenge, because we live in a culture that does not believe this. They believe just the opposite, in fact, and promote just the opposite. And you are constantly bombarded with just the opposite idea. So we are dealing here under Roman numeral 2 with the nature of the problem that we are not. We want to be even-handed in dealing with these things, that while we want to show the bankruptcy of materialism and that approach to life, we don't want to send out a bunch of false signals that everybody should be poor, for instance, or that everybody should sign off over all their money to the church. We don't buy any of that. That is indicative of a cult-like mentality, and that is a very regular feature, in fact, of the cults, as they insist on complete financial adherence to their agenda. Well, as believers under doctrine, we allow for the function of the royal priesthood, your volition, and you determine what you do financially. However, we will point out the issues that, number one, being poor is no big advantage, and again, poor people can be just as materialistic as rich people. Just because they don't have a lot doesn't mean they're not materialists. They could just be frustrated materialists, and a lot of poor people are just that. They are frustrated materialists. They can't have it, they can't get it, and so they're just as materialistic as people that have way, way more. We have pointed out that Christianity is not an ascetic religion. This is not designed to cause us to withdraw from the world, to attempt to deal with the STA through external means. We have to recognize that the nature of the problem lies within. It is, as Jesus said, out of the heart of man that come all these horrible things. And so we recognize that this problem is like any other STA problem. Not all people have it. Some people have it to some degree. Some people, it's not a big deal with them. Other people are quite materialistic and very focused on the material aspects of life. So, again, we're not insisting on or even suggesting that you give up all your worldly goods, that somehow if you're poor, you're better. You're not. That would be, it's like with prayer. If you determine as a believer that you want to fast, that's your business. There are no commands, say, in the New Testament to fast. But if you do that, do not think for a second that God hears you better on an empty stomach than he hears you on a full stomach. So don't think for a second that just because you're poor that God likes you better. That is, there is a reverse form of discrimination that goes on out there. I've been exposed to it and seen it, where poor people suggest that if somebody has more than they have, somehow they must be a spiritual washout. And that's not true either. So we're dealing with the several related problems here. Under point H is where we left off. We're talking about the issues of contentment in our niche. And the fact is a lot of believers are just malcontents. They're just discontented. They're not happy with what they have. They're always wanting more. And again, living in the last days in America, this is more of a problem because we are bombarded with this mentality. And so it makes it all the more difficult because largely, and I would say this is fairly true throughout Christendom, you don't hear this talked about because this would upset too many of the well-to-do people, as we might say, in the congregation or the big givers, and so we don't want to upset them. But see, we're you know, we don't care. We'll upset anybody. It doesn't matter to us. So we're not worried about how much you give or don't give. That's not an issue, and it can't be. You can't deal with doctrine based on, oh, I'm afraid this might upset somebody who is maladjusted to it. Well, you have to teach it the way it is, and sometimes it goes against you, sometimes it doesn't. You know, sometimes, you know, you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. It just depends on how it goes that day. Sometimes it goes against me, so I can't just duck it because, oh, I'm guilty in this area, so I can't teach about it. I have to deal with it just like I deal with the other areas. There's the issue of jealousy and envy, as we pointed out, and the malcontent that is so bad off that they resent anybody having anything if they don't have it. And that's just ludicrous. And the one we closed with was I, the desire to work hard and better one's station in life, is not in itself materialistic. In fact, the Bible speaks of this as a part of honorable character, and we saw those verses. That the diligent is the type of person that God's looking for. He's not looking for sluggards, people that waste their time, people that are lazy. So, Jay, the sinfulness of materialism has to do with two characteristics that distinguish it from an honorable work ethic. One, selfishness. This is the fundamental problem with all believers at all times. We have to all fight this. Selfishness takes various forms. Now, some people are overtly selfish, and it's obvious. It's all about them. You can see it. You can hear it in their speech. That's it. Then there's the other person who comes across as unselfish, but in fact is doing it for selfish reasons. So you have to be somewhat sophisticated in your thinking in regard to these issues, because some people may look squeaky clean on the surface, but just below the surface you scratch a little bit and you find there's all sorts of putrefaction, as Jesus said, and dead men's bones. So again, this is the challenge for all of us, is living for self. When you get self-centered, when it's all about you, you're not going to be happy, and the people around you aren't going to be happy, and life is going to be generally miserable, because God does not honor selfishness. That is the antithesis, frankly, of love. So two, excessiveness, the materialistic person pursues material ends at the expense of spiritual priorities, upsetting the proper balance and proportion God intends our lives to have. Okay, another aspect of this problem is that being objective about self is perhaps the most difficult thing we must do. A person generally does not think his own material pursuits are either selfish or excessive. So what others may be able to see readily from an external, and sometimes distance and detachment gives you a little more objectivity, but what other people may see clearly about us, we may not see clearly at all. And so one of the challenges there in 1 Corinthians, for instance, Paul alludes to it, is this deal of judging ourselves rightly. If we judged ourselves rightly, we would not be judged. And so one of the reasons we come under judgment is we're not effectively judging ourselves rightly. And that is a challenge because nobody wants to think badly of themselves. Nobody likes feeling like they're a slug or a worm or inferior or don't make it or whatever. But in reality, we have to deal with this as Christians on a day-to-day basis. We fail, we fall short, we sin, we stumble in many ways, and we have to acknowledge it and deal with it and move on. Knowing yourself isn't, you know, necessarily all that much fun. Once you get to know yourself, you might find out you're not that wonderful person that you thought you were. If you're objective about yourself, you're going to see things in your character that you don't like, that you wish weren't there. So we have to deal with those things, however, through doctrine. There is no secret shortcut to getting rid of them. We have to just continue to pound along and plow along and expose ourselves to the truth. And when it may be sometimes painful, that's just what it is. It's painful. Other times it's encouraging, and that's good. And again, somebody was telling me yesterday, it depends on where you are in your Christian life sometimes. Somebody said, well, didn't we just do this doctrine a couple of years ago? I said, yeah, we did. And they said, well, it was no problem for me then, but right now I'm having a real problem with this. Well, then this is all real timely. Then this is what we should be doing. So at some level, it depends on, you know, not whether you're positive or negative at that level, but just where you are in your Christian life or the tests you're going through. So, again, being objective is the challenging thing, but people most generally don't think when they're doing it for themselves that it is selfish. So those have to be the hard questions we sort of ask. Three, the sin of covetousness, the Greek term pleonexia, is translated in the New American Standard Bible by the English words covetousness, deeds of coveting, greed, and greediness. B, the verb pleonecteo, means to attempt to exploit someone, to cheat someone, or to take advantage of one in a material sense. See, this family of words is used 19 times in the New Testament and never in a good sense, and is defined as a mental attitude sin that arises from the lust pattern of the STA, which may or may not lead to an overt act. And that's a very important thing with mental attitude sins, of course. We don't always go overt with them. We may have them, but we don't always show our dirty laundry in public, and that's good. Everybody doesn't need to know how horrible you really are. We've got enough of an idea already, thank you. So we don't always go overt with it, which is good. But we have to still acknowledge that it's there and deal with it mentally. D, it must be recognized that covetousness is not a totally subjective concept. It is an objective reality that we are expected to understand, recognize, and avoid. E is one of the few specific sins singled out as grounds for separation, 1 Corinthians 5:11. And we're going to review the doctrine of separation shortly, so I won't go into great detail here, but the issue of separation here, the Corinthians, like almost everything, had fouled it up. And they had taken the doctrine of separation to an extreme that Paul never intended it. And that was, I wrote to you not to associate with immoral people, verse 9. And I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world or with the covetous or swindlers or idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world. So if you take separation to mean I'm never going to even speak to someone who's negative, well, good luck. How are you going to do that? And first, that's not what the doctrine says either, by the way. That's not what it teaches. It does teach that we do not go out and pursue social life and all of that with people who are negative. It does teach that we fellowship with positive volition. But it doesn't teach that we avoid everybody. I mean, how are you going to do that? So some people have taken this to extremes, that it was never intended. The Corinthians took it to an extreme, never intended. And I see believers, you know, they talk about this, and they're ready to separate from everybody. And I think this is a function somewhat of spiritual adolescence, and somewhat, and maybe even spiritual childishness. That we're ready to separate from everybody by God because we're just so damn good. Well, that's not God's attitude. If God had that attitude, where would we be? And the answer is nowhere. We wouldn't have salvation. So the point is here, again, this can be taken to extremes where believers are running off, separating from each other over minor issues. That's never been what the doctrine taught. And I think sometimes when we're younger spiritually, it's far easier to just take a superior attitude and stay away from anything we don't like personally and call it separation or any people we don't like personally. And that has nothing to do with separation, frankly. That is a distortion of separation. But I actually wrote to you here not to associate with any so-called brother. He's talking about believers and establishing social life with people who claim to be positive, adjusted believers, who are engaging consistently in these overt sins that are known to people, that are flagrant. Should he be an immoral person? Well, wait a minute. Hasn't every man lusted in his heart? Jesus said they have. Jimmy Carter said he did. So it must be true. Of course. So does that make you an immoral person because you've committed mental attitude lust? No, it does not. We're talking about people that are effectively immoral overtly, that are engaged in immoral activities. And not just, oh, they slipped, they sinned, they rebounded, they recognized it was wrong, and they never did it again. Now, that's the ideal case. But we're talking about people in an ongoing situation of adultery or immorality, about which is well known. Or the covetous. Or an idolater. Or a reviler. Or a drunkard. Or a swindler. Not even to eat with such a one. So, one, the instruction to withdraw from the monetary reversionist. Now, that's the covetous person. Would be pointless if it were not possible to know objectively when a person is consistently engaging in it. And then, two, many believers have serious emotional and spiritual issues with those that commit immorality and other things in this list. And rightly so. We're not saying, on the one hand, oh, well, this is worse than immorality. No, it's not. But people shudder and cringe and run the opposite direction when they hear some horror story about immorality. And we're not in favor of immorality, by the way. But we're not in favor of any of these other things either. Idolatry or revilers or drunkards or swindlers. And so we're not in favor of any of this stuff on this list. But if we can't know objectively when a person is doing this and is consistently doing this, and this is one of the challenges of being in a local church, believers, iron sharpens iron. And one of the guys on one of my lists the other day, he emailed me back and was thanking me for my words of wisdom, of course. And he said, you know, iron sharpens iron, but it dawned on me that they have to touch. Yes, they have to touch. And believers have to have contact with one another. And so we have opportunity to exhort one another in these areas where we see, oh, you're falling short. And, of course, what's our first response when somebody comes to us and says, I'm here to help you? No, you're not. Sign of the cross. Well, we don't want to hear about it. Well, this is where believers can help one another and pray for one another and encourage one another. And it's not always fun. It's not always neat. So if it's not objectively possible to know when a person's consistently doing it, well, then this list doesn't mean anything. I mean, well, we could say anybody's covetous. Because they lusted after a detail once, does that make you a covetous person? No. So, or even if it's something you struggle with but stay on top of, does that make you a covetous person? Well, you may have that trend, but you may stay on top of it, and that's good. That's what we encourage. So, but how many instances can you cite of people separating from those that make money in the details of life their MPR? Generally, these are the people that people, you know, court a buddy up to. Hey, they got lots of money. I've found out that if I hang out with certain people, they've got money and they're happy to spend it, and I'm happy for them to spend it on me. And you know, and let's face it, every, you know, we may have all done that at least once in our lives, or we're certainly aware of the possibility of it. But that's not what we're to do. We're not to pursue those people who have money and that kind of thing. So people will separate from all sorts of things. But do you ever hear people making money the issue? This person, you know, no. I just generally don't hear that. F, when it comes to the desire for money and material things, it appears to be difficult for us to see and admit that our own desires have become selfish or excessive. How do we know when we're excessive? But again, you try to factor this in with the fact that the average person in this world lives on a $500 per year per capita income. We have no conception of that in Babylon because we have been a golden cup in the Lord's hands. We've been blessed over all these years. And so, again, we have to, this is the challenge to make this personal. You have to deal with it yourself. And don't come to me and say, well, so-and-so seems to really be covetous. You worry about you. So-and-so can take care of themselves. And I'll just tell you the same thing I would tell anybody anyway. If you've got a problem with the believer, what does the scripture say? Doesn't it say to go to that believer? It doesn't say go to the pastor. And fortunately, see, no one here has been doing this, or you'd really be cringing now, wouldn't you? So don't think, oh, who's doing that? It's probably that approbation girl. Well, four, our materialistic addiction. A, our pattern of behavior in regard to money and material things very often fits the pattern of an addiction. One, certain elements are common to all addictive experiences. And the following is a list of widely acknowledged characteristics of an addiction. I didn't get these out of the Bible. This is common sense and good psychology. This is good biblical and even modern anthropology. The study of man will show you certain things if you study his character and his nature. Which must be considered in relation to the problem that many people have with money and material things. Two, an addictive experience creates predictable and reliable sensations, becomes the primary focus, and absorbs attention, temporarily eradicates pain and other negative emotions, provides an artificial sense of self-worth, power, control, and security, exacerbates the problems and feelings that it has sought to remedy, and leads to a loss of relationships. We'll take alcohol as a perfect example of this. You can take alcohol, and you look at the person that becomes an alcoholic, and look at all these things on this list. Well, all these things are true of them. Or a person that becomes addicted to sex, or to drugs, or to power, or approbation, or to money and materialism. Some people go out and shop because they get physical pleasure from it. I mean, it makes them happy. I mean, they might as well just light up a joint, drive down the road, because I'm going shopping. And you don't see, people on the news decrying this, do you? You don't see any commercials for, parents, the anti-materialism. They're never condemning that. So they're off to get their shopping high, and they come back, and then they go through withdrawals, and they got to do it again. And there are people like that. Hopefully you're not one of them. So B, can it be denied that millions of Americans display these very same addictive traits in their behavior about material things? See, unlike the addictions on which our society frowns, let's give them the dirty face, we don't like sex, drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, etc. Those are addictive, and those are horrible, bad, bad things. A materialism is an addiction that many in America exalt and applaud. One, people praise the person driven by materialism for pursuing, quote, the American dream. Oh, it's an American dream, all right. It's a big fantasy land they live in. People buy millions of books, tapes, videos that exalt the pursuit of wealth. Susie Orman, Dare to be Rich. Yeah, I'll try it. Regis Philbin, who wants to be a millionaire? Everybody, Regis. Well, can you answer 15 questions? I know, I just want to be a millionaire. I don't, Carlton Sheets, How to Make Money Off of Real Estate. I mean, we're bombarded with this stuff all the time. It's on PBS as good educational material sometimes. I don't believe PBS ought to be exalting materialism and how to get wealthy, but they do. So three, people flock to financial seminars, workshops, and rallies that inflame our materialistic tendencies, giving loud ovations to motivational speakers who specialize in the dream of wealth. The best motivational speaker I ever saw was Matt Foley, and he lived in a van down by the river. He wasn't a materialist, clearly. He didn't succeed. But the reality is, if you're, it's an inside joke. If you're not getting it, it's off of Saturday Night Live. But the point is, people go to this and, you know, they applaud it. I mean, I was watching Sex and the City the other day on a rerun, and there was this motivational speaker about Dare to Love. And they're all applauding her, and, oh, this is great. And all she's doing is up there spouting off platitudes. I mean, nothing that was really of any substance. And put yourself out there, and love is for you. Repeat your affirmations daily. I can see the wealth. I can be the wealth. Well, guess what? People go for that all the time. I mean, I get it in the paper, and then we get the little, if you guys get it, the little weekly paper, the little three one they throw in your driveway. One of the things in it, there's constantly these deals for an advertisements. I get them in the mail, too. If you're 50 or over, come to this free financial seminar. Now, why would they want me at a free financial seminar? And they'll have it at like Ruth's Chris or Fleming's with a free meal. Sounds good to me. But what are they trying to sell me? And they tell, nothing will be sold at this seminar. Right. Except for me, I'm going to get sold down the river. The problem with materialism, D, is any addiction is that the fix never lasts long enough, never lasts, although people think it always will. And so the people that get there, they are so psyched by shopping. I got a bargain. Oh, wow. How did I live without this bargain? I went to the dollar store. Everything was marked down to a penny. I bought it all. Well, good. Did you need any of it? Well, no. You know. Like the old Louis Anderson deal. His mom's out at a garage sale. Hey, get that toaster cord. It's worth a quarter. Toaster cord's worth a quarter? Well, yeah, but we don't need a toaster cord. We don't even have a toaster, for goodness sake. So, again, people, they get off on this, and guess what? That little high that you got off of your great bargain's going to fade pretty quick. You know, that car, that house, pick any detail, whether it's a major detail or a minor one. When you first get it, what's it like? Oh, it's so real, and it's mine, the precious. Well, and guess what? Then you got to ride across it. These words. These lovely words off every one of your details. Destined to perish. Am I taking any of these things to heaven with me? Don't think so. As Paul said to Timothy, it's clear that we brought nothing into this world. And it's also clear that we're not taking anything out. So, you got this great new detail and you love it. And it's fine and it's great. And you go out and somebody's dinged your car. How can you live after that? It's almost as though you feel half of you has died. Well, let's go get a new car. Well, guess what? There's nothing wrong. We're not against new cars. I mean, if you want to get a new car, that's your business. But the point of all this is, once you get that detail, the happiness fades. And then you think later on, that thing that brought you so much happiness a year ago, 2 years ago, man, I need a new one. Again, why have a 32 or a 50-inch TV? Get the 102-inch sucker. Get a TV bigger than a room that you've got to put it in. And that'll show people that you're serious about video. So, E, if the money and the things they were were really the objects of our need, then having them would be satisfying. However, having them is not satisfying in any lasting way. Some people have no sooner made one acquisition than we are craving another. Should it be they are craving another there, but that's fine. To the extent that it applies to you, you know, take it as it's intended. F, for many, it is not the money and the things that we need that we get high on. It is the acquiring them. But once we get those things we so desperately, and I love the way people throw this word around. Why'd you get it? Oh, I needed it. Wait a minute. Why did you need an outboard motor? You don't even have a boat. And no, you didn't need it. And people call all kinds of things needs when in fact they can't make the distinction between what's a need and what's a greed. And sometimes it's just pursuing our own greeds. Well, the fix wears off quickly and we're off in search of a new high, Ecclesiastes 5:10. But we're down on heroin addicts, right? See the double standards that we live with in our society all the time? And by the way, I'm not in favor of heroin addiction either. Lest you around and say, well, he seemed to think. Maybe I ought to get a dime back. You know, I don't know. No, we're not. What we are talking about, though, is that there are things that are just as bad for you that may not appear as destructive, but are every bit as destructive because it becomes an addiction. Or can be. Let's put it that way. Ecclesiastes 5:10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. That's good to know. Nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. And this term, the whole concept of vanity permeates this entire book. This book was written by Solomon. Solomon was a great believer. Obviously, became king of Israel under David, or after David died. And he was David's son through Bathsheba. That really sends people spinning. This was an object of a murderous, adulterous affair, and he becomes the king of Israel. Now, go figure. Isn't that interesting? Why? Because he was pretty positive. He was very positive, in fact. And God looks beyond what other people look at, and he sees the positive volition that lies there underneath. And so Solomon lived his life, and he got, at one time he was very great spiritually, got increased, really blessed by God, and then began to go wayward, stopped applying the doctrine of separation, started associating with all these women. That's what got him into trouble, was women. 700 wives and 300 concubines. Wow. And I think one woman's hard to deal with. Think about dealing with 1,000 of them. Of course, he never had to deal with them. That was the beauty of it. He just, you know, if he wanted them, he called them. And that was it. So we're not in favor of that either, of polygamy and all that. So the point is, though, Solomon began to went off into this period of spiritual stupidity for quite some time, and after he recovered from it, and he went through some really weird things. Like if you back up into chapter 2, and the whole theme of this book is vanity of vanities, emptiness, void, nothing. Nothing is nothing, says the preacher. Everything is nothing. Nothing matters. Chapter 2, so I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Wow, that sounds like fun. You're the king of Israel. How many pleasures do you think he has access to? All of them. And behold, it was futility. It was emptiness. Didn't mean anything. And I said of laughter, it is madness. And I said of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Nothing. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely. In other words, he would drink to the point just where he wasn't drunk. As close to drunk as he could get, but he was still in control. And he would drink and drink and drink, and he would think and think and think. God, that sounds fun. Boring. And I would take hold of folly until I could see what there was good to do under heaven. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted a vineyard. So Solomon would get, you know, as close to drunk as you can get and still be cognizant and still be in control. And he would dream up these grandiose schemes while he was buzzing. And he'd be sitting around drinking, oh man, what can I do next? And he'd be thinking about it. And he'd devise these plans. And then, once he sobered up, he'd go out and execute them. He went out and built everything he thought about doing. And that's what he's talking about here. I enlarged my works. I built houses. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I planted them on all kinds of trees. I made ponds of water. I bought male and female slaves. I had homeborn slaves. I possessed flocks. I collected gold in verse 8 and silver. I provided myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. So he basically just went off and whatever he felt like doing, he did. And he had all the money and all the time and all the resources to pull this off. And God let him do it. Now go figure that one. I mean, he came under some discipline and all this, but God didn't kill him or anything. And here he is, king of Israel. I mean, you go in, here's the king of Israel, slosh, dreaming up these grandiose ideas, and you're thinking, what? But this was the way it was. So all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was the reward. See, he figured he earned it. I earned this. I'm the king. I can do it. And he looks at it after all, and I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, it was all emptiness. all void, all futility, all vanity, and striving after wind. And there was no profit under the sun. So, Solomon's a case study in this. Does materialism satisfy? No. Nothing really fully satisfies. And he sums it all up at the end of the book. And he wrote all this after he kind of came back spiritually from this state he was in, we might call it. I assume it was some form of reversionism. And he comes back from it. He recovers. And he writes this book, and at the end of it all, he sums it all up with some pretty simple advice. Chapter 12. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. You better focus on God early and often. And then, of course, the conclusion, verse 13, when all has been heard, fear God and keep His commandments. Because this applies to every person. And God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. He's not going to be fooled. So again, the fact is, these things don't satisfy. Solomon had the ability to explore materialism in ways that you and I can't even begin to fathom. I mean, can you imagine that you live on the planet, you're the most powerful person in the world at that time, and you can do anything you want. If you decide you want to have your wife killed and get you 10 more, you can. You could. Any detail you want, go buy it. Any grandiose scheme you can dream up, let's execute it. Anything you wanted. I need a new chariot. He had a new chariot. I want a custom-made chariot with some fuzzy dice. You know, I need it to be lowered. You know, I need a low rider. I need a Mercedes chariot. I need a Jag. I need a BMW chariot. You know, all the translating it into modern terms. You can have as many cars as you want. One of every kind that trips your trigger. What would you drive if you could drive anything for free? Well, and what would you do if you had all this time on your hands and all this money and you could execute all this stuff? Well, Solomon went through all of this and said, at the end of it, it's empty. It's void. It's vain. It's nothing. It doesn't amount to anything. Well, gee, materialism is not a problem limited to the wealthy any more than immorality is limited to a certain segment of society. H, materialism is a problem of the attitude, an erroneous standard. It is a part of a faulty thought processes. And it is just as much a sin for those who have little as it is for those who have much. In other words, the rich, the poor, and everyone in between may be equally materialistic. J, therefore, a person's outward standard of living, whether high or low, is not always an accurate indicator of whether or not he is materialistic. The fact that Sam Walton drove an old pickup truck does not guarantee he was not materialistic. He may have simply been too miserly to buy a better truck. And there are rich people like that. I know some people that have got more money than God. And they will drive to Tampa to save $30 on a plane ticket. Now, if I had endless wealth, I would fly out of Sarasota every time, trust me. Oh, and speaking of which, I will be taking off. This is a good time. I'll announce it again. But April the 19th through the 26th, there will be no class. And we will resume the 27th, which is a Wednesday. So that's about 5 weeks from now. So some people, they have a lot of money. We had people when I was working at the pharmacy. They would drive 20 miles from Longboat Key, go through that god-awful traffic on St. Armand's, and to come down to the pharmacy to save 50 cents on a prescription. And you probably know people like that or have met them. And so guess what? Just because he drives an old truck doesn't tell you anything about his character. Or he may just prefer to invest his fortune in securities rather than vehicles. Okay, one overlooked aspect of materialism is the problem of consumer debt among believers, which is a disgrace, frankly. One, not being able to say no to what we want is more than just a childish bad habit. It is a grown-up sin. Sometimes, you know, hey, I've got a credit card. It's God's will. What? No. We've always exhorted you, if you have credit cards, use them wisely. Pay off your debt at the end of every month for the most part. Try not to carry a balance. The interest will eat you up. And you got to learn how to use. See, we have to live in the devil's world, but we've got to learn how to be smart about it. Or we're going to end up just like every other idiot out here, drowning in consumer debt. And you ought to try to be as liquid as you can financially. So, not to say it's ever wrong to borrow money for something. Obviously, most of us do not have the money to go out and buy a house with cash, and you have to finance, but be wise about it. For instance, I financed back when, you know, when I got my house, when the rates were as low as they could be, I waited till they got as low as they would get, and then I financed. And then when they hit the bottom again, I went out and I refinanced and lowered my payments. Well, actually, I raised my payment, but I lowered my, I saved $30,000 in interest. So if you do finance something, finance it for as short a term as possible. Pay it off as quick as you can. And you can put extra money onto the principal every month. I put extra money onto every principal of every bill I've got every month. And I think that's a part of being a good steward. If you're paying 5, 6, 7, 8%, the quicker you pay that off, you're 5, 6, 7, 8% ahead. That's interest coming out of your money. So, too many believers live beyond their means, refuse to budget their finances. That's another whole deal. If you don't live on a budget, if you don't have a budget, you're headed for financial trouble. You need to have a budget. You need to have some organization. You can buy Quicken. The little program makes it real simple to do. You can set up a budget in there. And then you can track your expenses. And you can see, oh, I'm not staying on my budget too well. I have $1,000 in income and I spent $3,000 this month. Now, how long can you do that if you're not the federal government? Not very long. And I saw in the news this week, they're going to make it harder and harder now for you to file bankruptcy, which I'm in favor of. Bankruptcy's just cost the rest of us. Why? People go out and spend themselves into debt. Well, I can't pay it. Let's give the bill to Ron. I don't want it. I want to pay my bills. I don't want to pay yours or some other idiot that couldn't control themselves. And so my deal is if you file bankruptcy, fine. You lose everything as far as that's the way it should be, I think. No, we'll let you keep your house and your car and no-hoo-hoo. Get rid of it all, man. If you can't pay your bills, you suffer. That was the law of the Old Testament, and that was a good law. So, again, many people refuse to budget their finances. You've got to have a budget, and you've got to stick to it. It's a challenge, I know, especially when you're bombarded every day with 90 things you need to have. And there are enough unexpected expenditures that you have to make, sickness, illness, these kinds of things you have to try to plan for. So they are living proof of the old adage that when a person's outgo exceeds his income, then his upkeep will be his downfall. And that was pretty well put, I thought. Well, in some cases, we had parents who wanted to, quote, give us all the things they never had. How many, if you've ever said that, stifle yourself, Edith. What in the world make parents think that this was a mandate from God? They treat this like it's a mandate from God. This isn't in the Bible. This is human viewpoint. And people buy into it. And they never taught us how to do it without anything we really want or to exercise fiscal self-discipline. And many people have buying habits that are undisciplined and not restrained by common sense, income, or anything else. They simply will not be held back from having whatever they want. And many people are at the mercy of their impulses, charging what they want on credit cards, indulging their desires immediately with no need to pay until later. Rooms to go, no payments till 2010. I need new furniture. Do you really? Do you really? And if you need something, no believer in this congregation better be guilty if somebody needs something and they go buy it of looking down on them or treating them as though they shouldn't have done that. That's not your business, frankly. It's their business. So, but if you see a believer that's constantly in financial problems, constantly can't pay their bills, constantly living beyond their means, that's a different story. That's quite a different story. So we're not against people getting anything new. So if you've got something new lately, don't feel guilty. That's another whole thing. You can't do all this stuff out of guilt. Guilt is not an appropriate motivation for why you do things. So, very few people have escaped the dangers of living in an economy based on the principle of consumerism, the economic theory that a progressively greater consumption of goods is beneficial. And guess what? That's wrong. That's a theory, but it's wrong. A progressively greater consumption of good doesn't do you any benefit at all. At all. In fact, it can make you cynical and jaded because, I mean, what is it we haven't experienced? What do we deny ourselves? I want to do everything, so therefore I should be able to do everything. And if I've got the money, it's God's will. Well, no, not necessarily. That's what we're talking about. People need to stop and think. They need to stop and pray sometimes. You know, I've decided I'm going to go get blank. Did you pray about it? Did you ask God to bless you? Did you check to see if he even wants you to have it? No, I just know what I'm doing. Okay. Well, that type of mentality will get you into trouble. So, consequently, we are plagued by two different kinds of pressure, both of which destroy our peace of mind. First, the advertisers and the entertainment media generate a standard of living pressure by portraying as the norm a standard of living that is above what all but a few will ever have, implying that if we do not live at this level, we are missing out on something that is the birthright of every American. See, there was, when I was a little kid, and I don't remember the name of the song, but one of the lines in it was, "The world owes me a living." And I go around saying, "Oh, the world owes me a living." And, you know, no, it doesn't. We're indoctrinated with it even as kids. No. Well, it's just a harmless song. Well, tell me Ozzy's songs are harmless about worshiping the devil and drinking blood. Are those harmless? No. Well, this mentality that people owe you anything is bogus. Nobody owes you anything. You didn't come in here with more rights than I've got or anybody else. Nobody owes anybody anything. Second, we generate a harmful debt pressure by spending more than we make, trying to achieve the standard of living, quote, norm that we have been led to believe is our right. And three, this speaks loudly to a lack of discernment when we get caught up pursuing the details of life. Q, another material aspect of our materialistic addiction is the competitive aspect of it, getting so caught up in standard of living comparisons that our enjoyment of what we have often depends on how few other people have the same thing. One, consider the marketing program problems of a company like American Express. The success of whose products depends on a perception that very few people have them. And that's how they've always marketed their card. Do you need to pay $85 to have a credit card? No. No, you don't. But you can get free credit cards all over the place, even low-interest free credit cards. But it doesn't have the status of American Express, right? That's what they are psyching people into believing. That if you got an American Express card, it speaks to who you are. Really? Well, I have several pieces of plastic in my wallet and some business cards. Is this who I am? A Social Security card? Didn't write too good when I was in seventh grade. Well, look, does this speak to who I am? No. A man's life does not consist of the abundance of credit cards he possesses. So, two younger married couples are especially prone to materialistic competition among themselves. And often there is an unspoken pressure to have what other couples have. If you don't have it, what's wrong with you? I mean, they do this in very many areas. If you're not married by the time you're 25, what's wrong with you? If you're married and you don't have kids, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you if you don't have a house or a car or all the things that people's... I mean, you have to have certain things, I understand. But to have this idea that there's something wrong with me because I don't have it, that's ludicrous. Our materialism has contributed to making many into a nation of neurotics. It is obvious that the higher the standard of living in a society, the higher the incidence of worry, anxiety, and neurosis. Ecclesiastes 5:12. And this is why some of these, quote, backward societies are far more happy. And this pursuit of the almighty dollar and having these things, what's it getting us? It's getting us a nation filled with Prozac addicts. They kind of outlawed Valium, but they got the new Valium. It's Xanax, and it's substantially, it's chemically the same. Diazepam is Valium, and Xanax is very chemically similar, and every bit is addictive. But, you know, we had that movie, whatever it was, about the Valium freak, and so they had to outlaw Valium. So Ecclesiastes 5:12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. And so we now have all these new diseases that are made from people that eat indulgent meals all the time, too much fat, too much sugar in their diets, and they wonder why they have digestive problems. And these kinds of things. Way too much protein. You go up to the gym and you look at these guys at the gym. staggering around with their protein drinks. Protein's the last thing they need. And so, again, what's this all gotten us? I got to have an alarm now because somebody will break in to steal all my details. I'm not against alarms either, by the way. But if you have one or if you don't have one, you know, I remember when we lived in a society where you didn't even have to lock your doors. But again, I was born in Mayberry, so that's me. And now I live in Bart Simpson land. It is indeed a brave new world, isn't it? Are we any better off, though, with all the money, all the details, all the things? Oh, we all got more than our parents had, didn't we? Isn't everybody here probably better off than their parents were? Sure. Are we happier for it? No. Not because, again, happiness is not key to what you have, or shouldn't be. Five, the dangers of wealth. The New Testament clearly teaches that wealth, while not inherently evil, does involve some real dangers. 1 Timothy 6, 9 and 10. And you'll hear people quote or misquote this verse all the time. Money is the root of all evil. Is that what the verse says? No, it doesn't say that at all. But you'll hear people say that like it, you know, and they quote it like it's the Bible. Like, God helps those that help themselves. Where's that verse again? Doesn't say that. The love of money is a root, invisible, unseen, below the ground, of all sorts of evils. The overt manifestations of a love of money create a lot of things. Some people love money and they join the mafia. They become hitmen. Why? Because they're out to kill people? No, it pays well. And some people love money and they make illegal stock trades. And then they go to prison for 5 months. And their stock triples while they're in prison. Somebody could have had that happen. So, what kinds of evils will these people do? You never know. I mean, the root you don't see, but the root is a love of money. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith. People have violated doctrine in the pursuit of the almighty dollar. I can get a better job in a place where there's no face-to-face teaching. What's God's will? Do you really have to ask? You don't know, seriously? God's will for you to stay where you are. In the geographic niche he assigned you, not to go pursuing the almighty dollar. Well, I'd have to move to Afghanistan, but there's a lot of money to be made. Kidnap victim number 12, come on down. Hostage number 46, why are all these people hostages? They're over there making money, that's why they're there. They're not there out of humanitarian need or care. They're there because they're getting rich. Halliburton's doing quite fine, thank you. Bush's cronies are doing all right. Cheney's cronies are doing all right. So verse 9, I want to read that too. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation. You're tempted in ways that you're not going to be tempted if you don't pursue this. You're tempted to compromise. You're tempted to skip Bible class because you can make a little money on the side. You're tempted to do this. Where are you when the applications need to be made? Well, I got to make some money. Well, but yeah, but your fellow believers need help. Well, I'm busy. Oh, good. See you at the bema seat. We'll see who's busy. We'll see who wins in this thing. And a snare. And many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. Paul's kind of an alarmist, isn't he? Or wait a minute, is this all too true? And it is. It's all too true. So B, warnings like these have little effect on most of us at the practical level, since most people seem to conveniently define rich as a level of affluence above what they have or above that to which they aspire. So if I ask everybody here today, are you rich? Everybody here, look at me, are you crazy? But if I went down, if I brought over, some kid from Afghanistan and I pointed to any of you and said, are they rich? Yeah. Yeah, they are. So it's relative, one thing. And we live in such a relatively rich culture that we conveniently define rich as what we don't have. Are you rich, Ron? Well, I've got money in the bank. That means you're rich. If you've got money in the bank, if you've got disposable income, you're rich. You've got more money than you need. That's rich at a certain level. So one, as a result, even if they are more prosperous than those around them, They still aspire to just have one more thing or live more comfortably. They are not conscious of aspiring to be rich. And two, unfortunately, this leads to a condition in which the conscience can become content to ignore the divine assessment of their pursuits. This gets into our consciences as well. Issues with the conscience. Does your conscience bother you? But from time, you know, what am I doing? Does it ever pull you up short and say, hey, whoa, this is out of line? My conscience smites me all the time, but then again, I'm a big sinner. So it should. So, but am I the only one? So, all right, well, our time is up. We'll actually, we're going to pick up here at about 10 after because we got started late and we finished a little late. So we'll take a break till about 10 after today.